From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. On today's show, a high school student, a young woman, carrying a homemade political sign, is surrounded by older male students chanting, "Lock her up."
I think she unfortunately got a taste firsthand of what partisan politics has descended to in this country.
The Detroit Archdiocese is gathering to seek direction for Catholics.
What's going to help us make us missionary, and what's getting in the way of making us missionaries?
A scientist and policy expert is alarmed by what's expected from the Trump administration regarding climate change policy.
To see that destroyed by a group of ideologues is tragic.
And Thanksgiving is next week. We've got a cocktail that just might help keep the peace among the family.
And then what brings it all together is some ginger beer. So we shake up the bourbon and the shrub together.
Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. The director of the University of Michigan's Energy Institute is extremely concerned about the potential gutting of environmental protections.
Pulling back from the commitments that have been made by the Obama administration is nothing short of a global tragedy.
And there's more circling within our solar system than we ever knew.
We found about 50 other trans-Neptunian minor planets. Dede is simply the largest and the most interesting. But of course, the bigger prize out there is Planet Nine.
But first, across Michigan and across the nation, there have been reports of violence against people. MLive reports police say a man beat a cab driver of East African descent in Grand Rapids and repeatedly yelled, "Trump." In Marquette, there are reports a white man shoved a black woman to the ground and said, "I hope President Trump does what he says he's going to do. He should send you all," and I'll insert the N-word, "back to Africa." Students at Royal Oak Middle School taunted Latino classmates by chanting, "Build the wall." In Ann Arbor, a white man demanded a Muslim woman remove her hijab, her head covering, or he would burn her alive. There are more, too many more. Joining us to talk about this is Susan Demas. She's the publisher of Inside Michigan Politics. So what do you make of these attacks?
I feel like this is pretty unprecedented as far as what usually happens in this country post-election. I mean, a lot of us do remember the very, very close and contentious 2000 election and the recount, and tensions were high and there were protests. But to see hate crimes really spike after an election is deeply alarming, and it should be for everybody, regardless of who you supported.
You wrote a column for Eclecta Blog titled "When Post-Election Bullying Hits Home." In it, you describe how your daughter took a homemade sign to her high school. Would you describe that sign for us?
Yeah. So 2 days after the election, my daughter, who's a member of the political club at school, wrote a handmade sign that said, "We will fight for America." She crossed out, "We have failed America," because that's not a sentiment that she supports. And the sign also included things that she believes in, like marriage equality, gun control, women's rights, is supportive of people of all races. So she was walking down the hallway. This was the Thursday after the election, and a group of older boys surrounded her. And one of them actually got up on a bench, and they were all yelling, "Lock her up." And I think we're all familiar with the phrase. We heard it at a lot of Donald Trump rallies in regard to Hillary Clinton. I have to say I was rather surprised that it would be used on my 14-year-old daughter.
So how was this handled by school officials?
I feel like the school district handled it very swiftly and with sensitivity. I know that parents in other school districts had much different experiences, and that's unfortunate. But Okemos, I think, is a very diverse community, and you have a lot of very involved parents and a great staff. And the last thing that I think anybody wants to see are really harsh divisions. And I thought the superintendent, Catherine Ash, handled it very well by sending out an email district-wide, and my personal dealings with her have been great.
This incident involving your daughter has been fairly widely reported. What kind of reactions have you and your daughter received since these stories came out?
The reaction has been overwhelmingly positive. You know, I think people have been very impressed with the way my daughter handled things, and they should be. I mean, she's 14 years old. When I was in high school, I would not have handled this with such aplomb. I can tell you that. You know, not surprisingly, there have been some anonymous trolls who have said some very offensive things, but I'm a columnist. I have been for a decade, so this is not new to me. It's a little new to my daughter, but this is the world we live in. And, you know, I just hope that what this has done is made other students who felt uncomfortable in one way or another or who were targeted, maybe they understand that, you know, they can speak out and that they don't have to suffer in silence. I don't want anyone to feel like I'm equating her experience with some of those, you know, hate crime incidents that you described, because those are really violent incidents. And although, you know, they seem to involve adults, still, I understand that we're very fortunate that we didn't have that experience.
You know, and are friendly with a number of conservatives. So what are your conservative friends saying about these kinds of incidents, or this one in particular?
You know, to be honest, I feel like everything has become partisan nowadays. And while my close conservative friends have all been very supportive, some people that I'm friendly with, have told me that they don't want to say anything publicly, lest it be construed as, you know, them being somehow disloyal. And, you know, in terms of my daughter's experience, I do think that some conservatives have felt that, you know, to say something like on my Facebook page is a declaration that, you know, they didn't quite support Donald Trump all the way, which is a really weird place to be, because this is just an incident about a kid. And I certainly never expected that it would get this much attention. All I hope is something good comes from it, and that maybe people are just basically nicer to each other, and that other kids who feel targeted feel like they're not alone.
You're kind of getting to where I wanted to go. I mean, what's the real takeaway here? What's the lesson to be learned for your daughter?
Well, I think she unfortunately got a taste firsthand of what partisan politics has descended to in this country. You know, there's not a whole lot of civility left anymore, as you and I both know. But, you know, she has had several students at her school come up to her and tell her about their experience. And they've been very happy that she's spoken out. And that's meant a lot to her.
Susan Demas is the publisher of Inside Michigan Politics and a regular guest here on Stateside on Fridays. Thanks very much for taking the time.
Oh, thanks, Lester.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Hi, Tammy.
Hi, Lester.
That's Tammy Coxon with Tammy's Tastings, and we're here to hear about another cocktail. Thanksgiving is coming up.
That's right. And everybody's always worried on Thanksgiving about what to serve their guests. And so today I have a drink that's really versatile and is a crowd pleaser.
All right. Well, tell us about it.
So it's the McClary's Mule. And this is just a riff on the classic Moscow Mule. And it features a great Michigan product, which is McClary's drinking vinegars.
Drinking vinegars. I haven't heard about that. Tell me about that.
So back in colonial times, they were sometimes called shrub, and this was a way of preserving fruit with vinegar so that you could save the harvest for enjoying later.
I've not heard about McClary's before. Where are they from, and how did they get started doing this?
They are a Michigan company, actually greater Detroit area, started by a woman named Jess McClary. She'd started off as a baker and wanted to do something different, something that still highlighted Michigan products. And she started doing some research and found out about shrubs and launched this product. And it's gone on to become really successful. In 2015, they were featured on ABC's Shark Tank. And they didn't get funded, but that publicity really helped them out. They got a lot more orders and a lot more distribution. So now they're in 27 different states.
All right. Well, tell me how you make it.
So to make the cocktail, we're using 3/4 of an ounce of McClary's cranberry shrub, but you could use any flavor that you like. They have a whole wide array of flavors. And then I used 1.5 ounces of bourbon, but you could easily make this with vodka instead. Both of those work really well. And then what brings it all together is some ginger beer. So we shake up the bourbon and or vodka and the shrub together. Strain it into a Moscow Mule mug if you have one, or just a glass if you don't. Fill it with some ice and top it off with ginger beer.
So tell me about this cup or mug that you have. It's copper. Why do you have to have a special mug or cup for this drink?
You don't have to, but it all goes back to marketing. So back in the 1930s, a man named John Martin had just bought the Smirnoff Company, and he had all this vodka. And while today vodka is really popular, back then people hadn't heard of it. They were kind of suspicious of this Russian product. And a man named Jack was sort of in a similar position. He was making ginger beer, and nobody really knew what that was or wanted to buy it either. So these two guys teamed up, and they created the drink called the Moscow Mule, which was just ginger beer, vodka, lime juice, and served in this copper mug. And the way that that worked was they would go around the country and they would go to a bar and they would talk to the bartender. They'd serve him this drink and the special mug. And then they'd use this fancy new invention called a Polaroid camera. And they would take a picture of the bartender holding this mug with this drink in his hand. And then they'd take another one and they'd leave one for him. And then they'd go down the street and they'd show the next bartender down the street the photo of his competitor with this product. And in the first year, they doubled the sales of vodka in the United States and then tripled them again the year after that. So
pretty good marketing.
Very successful marketing, and we still have this iconic mug today.
Well, let's have a sip of that. You can describe it for us.
So this is a really gingery ginger beer that we use today, and so the ginger flavor is coming through on the forefront. But then there's this really nice acidity that in a traditional Moscow Mule would be brought by some lime juice. Here it's coming with that shrub and also, of course, the cranberry flavor coming with that.
Now, when you say drinking vinegar, I think a lot of people, you know, they're going to be off-put by the idea of vinegar in their drink. But it's not really that horrible.
No, it's not at all. So it's apple cider vinegar, and then it has sugar added, and then, of course, the fruit juice is there in there as well. So it is not like adding distilled white vinegar to your drink, for sure. And that's the McClary's Mule.
Well, delicious. Thanks very much.
Cheers.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. The Catholic Archdiocese of Detroit is holding a synod this month, a meeting to determine priorities for them. Since the Archdiocese was established in 1833, there have only been 10 synods held, and the last one was in the 1960s. Joining us to talk about this rare gathering is Archbishop Alan Veneron. Why now?
Well, because this is what the Pope has asked us to be engaged in. Pope Francis says we need to be about a new evangelization, become a band of joyful missionary disciples. And a synod is a great way to galvanize the whole diocese to move us forward in this important goal.
So the synod will be held shortly, but you've been working on this. The parishes have been working on this for a while. Tell us about the input of the parishes and who gets to participate in the synod.
Well, in terms of the input, it really began with the whole diocese engaged in a year of prayer. After that, we had dialogue sessions in the parishes. We received about 11,000 different points of information, suggestions. Out of that, we developed a set of priorities. And now the members of the synod are beginning to deliberate on this. The membership in the synod is about 350 people. There's a member from each parish in the diocese. And then there are groups of priests, religious sisters, and lay people who are also appointed as special appointees.
This is being described as an attempt at a radical overhaul of the Catholic Church in Detroit. What do you mean by radical overhaul?
To change the culture, that's what I mean. Obviously, we don't change the constitution of the church. That's given to us by the Lord. But I use a parallel. In 1969, my predecessor, Archbishop Dearden, had a synod to be a first implementation of the Second Vatican Council. And as a result, it wasn't just a few things that changed, but our whole way of going about our life changed. We became what the Council spoke of as a church of the people of God. All sorts of cooperation, collaboration, consultation. What I mean is a phase two of implementing the Council, so that on the basis of this new strength we have, how do we change our culture away from maintenance to mission, to be a church on mission, as Pope Francis says?
The online literature about the synod indicates this is in part prompted by an, quote, unnatural deterioration of the church, the decline in sacramental participation and vocations, as well as the closing of parishes, are unnatural aberrations rooted in an erosion of evangelization. That's the end of the quote. Is this the beginning of, well, a membership campaign?
No, it's exactly not a membership campaign. This is about being on mission to present Christ to other people, and we'll see what happens. And if we hope that the circle of disciples will grow, but we're waiting for God's providence to bring that about. But this is not a membership campaign.
Again, from the online literature, one of the questions being tackled is how to make parishes, schools, hospitals, charitable organizations missionary-based. Missionaries, you know, evangelize. What does evangelism look like in a school or a hospital?
I think what it looks like in a school especially, and these would be two different things. In a school, it looks like presenting an understanding of the human person and the vocation that you present, you prepare people for, to think about that in the broadest possible terms and as a response to belonging to Christ. In a hospital, in healthcare, I think it means not simply performing the work of mercy in harmony with Christ or as a continuation of the ministry of Christ, but also giving people an explanation of what this means and why we're doing it, and taking occasions when we can invite people to join us in doing this. It's not proselytism. It isn't about saying, if you want these services, you have to join us. It's about witness, but being explicit in our witness of why we're doing it and inviting you to be part of it.
I've been looking at some of the other synods that have been held recently or will be held in Gary, Indiana, San Diego, Milwaukee, Rome, Vancouver. They've held held synods on subjects such as family and marriage and greater inclusion of lay people in church duties. So why Detroit? Why is Detroit focusing on missionary and evangelization?
Well, I would say it's principally in response to the calls we've gotten from Pope John Paul II and Pope Francis. I also think another way to explain this focus is to think in along the lines of what's been so significant here in Southeast Michigan. We have inherited a lot of institutions which have gotten, I don't know, let's say barnacles, a little ossified in the way we've done things. And we're looking for something that's going to take us back to the core mission, not just one topic, but what is the dynamic that gives life to dealing with all the kinds of topics about which you're speaking. Part of the culture of Southeast Michigan, part of the history of Southeast Michigan is to, as I read it, is that we're at a time where this is very essential to try and unleash the very dynamic of the institution's reason for existing.
The Detroit Archdiocese Synod 16 will take place November 18th through the 20th at the Westin Book Cadillac Hotel in Detroit. How long before the diocese, Archdiocese as a whole, gets to see the results or the decisions made at the Synod?
Well, the way I explain it is that the Synod is a time of discernment for the members to tell me what they see to the basic question of what's going to help us make us missionary and what's getting in the way of making us missionaries. I'm going to listen to that, and with help from others between the 20th of November and the first days of June, I'm going to do my discernment on that, say, having heard what the Synod is saying, this is where I think we need to go. This is where I want to lead us. So it's basically about 7 months. But in that seven-month time, there will continue to be elements of this process, timely feedback and staying in touch with the members of the Synod.
That is Archbishop Alan Vinneron. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Glad to be with you. Thank you very much, Lester.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. As technology gets better and, as we said, more probes out into our solar system, we're learning a lot. I mean, recently a photo from Jupiter from its south pole went viral on the internet. I mean, it's a photo of Jupiter. Well, there's a lot more out there. I mean, recently researchers have been trying to track down a theoretical Planet 9. Sorry, Pluto for the downgrade, by the way. And the latest comes from the University of Michigan. There might be a friend for Pluto. David Gerdes is a professor of physics and astronomy at Michigan. So just what do you think you found?
We've found what we think is a dwarf planet, a small minor planet that's orbiting in the solar system beyond Neptune, far, far, far beyond Pluto. What is interesting about this object is that it is more than twice as far away from the Earth right now and from the Sun as Pluto is.
Wow.
So if you want to get to see this thing, like the New Horizons probe got to see Pluto, you know, go on a spaceship for a decade or so, take a short rest at Pluto, but you're not even halfway there. So
right.
Keep going.
Yeah, that's amazing. How do you confirm something like this? I mean, you've got some measurements that are indicators, but you've got to get some confirmation here.
There is no doubt that this object exists, and what is a little bit less certain is whether it is truly a dwarf planet. This was found with the ground-based telescope, not with a space probe, but just using good old-fashioned telescopes on the ground. Now, it's a good old-fashioned 4-meter telescope, not the kind of thing you might look through in your backyard. But we've been doing a project here at Michigan and with collaborators around the country and around the world to use a new camera on a 4-meter telescope down in Chile, an optical telescope, just like the light we see with our eyes. And it's a digital camera, just like the kind of thing that you might have on your phone, but this one has 570 megapixels.
So a little more.
It's a little bit bigger. The size of the images on this thing is about the size of a manhole cover. It's, mm-hmm. it's a big wide field of view that can take in a region of the sky several times the area of the full moon. So it's pulling in a lot of light over a lot of area in each image. And the purpose of this survey had nothing whatsoever to do with finding objects in the solar system. What I like about what we've done is that we've found a way to use this data set for something other than what it was originally intended to do. What we intended to do was to make maps of distant galaxies and understand something about the large-scale structure and expansion of the universe. Although our goal is to look at distant galaxies, we're looking out through the dusty window of our solar system, and there's stuff in the foreground that gets in the way. For most of my collaborators, this is an irritating foreground that gets in the way of the stuff we're trying
to
see.
Right.
But I thought, wouldn't it be fun if we could try to find actually new things in the solar system that swim into view as we systematically scan the sky? Most of the objects in our pictures are stars in our own galaxy and other galaxies outside of our own. They stay in the same place every single night. We go back and look, they're still there. Just like when you go out in the backyard and look at the Big Dipper or Orion, you recognize that same pattern. It's the same from night to night. It's the same from decade to decade. Stars and galaxies are so far away that they just don't really move on human timescales. But things nearby, like the moon, planets, they do move in the night sky. They change their position against the background of the stars. What we tried to do was find things that were in one place on one night and then weren't there the next time we looked. We call those transients, something that was there and then wasn't there. The problem is that they're so darn common. There are lots and lots and lots of transients. Most of them are actually asteroids in the main belt between Mars and Jupiter. We wanted to look for things that are in the other asteroid belt in our solar system, which is in the region of the solar system beyond Neptune. The most famous thing out there is Pluto. What we found was a collection of dots that we were able to tie together with an orbit and say, these are not just some random dots in our images. This is actually the same thing that appeared in different places on different nights. At this point, there is no doubt we now have 3 years' worth of observations of this object. We know it's very distant because it moves extremely slowly, because it is very, very far away from the sun, and so it's orbiting extremely slowly.
How big is it? How long does it take to orbit the sun? Do you have enough data to figure those things out yet?
Dede takes a little over 1,100 years to orbit the sun. It takes more than four times as much time to go around the sun as Pluto does. It's in a very elongated, very elliptical orbit. At its closest approach to the sun, it will be about as close as Pluto is most of the time. It'll be about 40 times as far away from the sun as the Earth is. But that won't happen until the year 2142. We got lucky and happened to catch this thing well over a century before it makes its closest approach to the sun. To be seen that far out, we knew it had to be reasonably big. We figured out it's about the size of Iowa.
So you saw something in the sky in our solar system beyond Pluto, 92 times further from the sun than the Earth, the size of Iowa?
Let's try to put this in perspective. People like to make scale models of the solar system. Let's suppose the sun is the size of a basketball, and we place it at the 50-yard line in the big house. Earth is kind of a map pushpin at about the 20-yard line. And Dede is a little grain of sand a little over half a mile away. It's in the real cheap seats. We're still analyzing this data. My graduate student, Stephanie Hamilton, who named Dede for distant dwarf, is finishing that analysis now. But right now we think that Dede is a little over 320 miles in diameter. That would make it right at the borderline for dwarf planethood. The sort of arbitrary distinction that we draw for dwarf planets is, are they big enough to be round? Is their gravity strong enough to squeeze them into a round shape like a snowball? The only way to know for sure is to really take an actual picture and see that it's round, and that's kind of hard to do. Sometimes in science, getting that last 1% of certainty and to go from 99 to 100% is hard to do.
I guess the bigger question here is, since we're doing this, is there anything that we can use that you've been already using to find this that might help us find, like we mentioned earlier, Planet 9?
Planet 9. That gets to the heart of what's interesting about this. To me, the interesting thing about a dwarf planet like Dede is not that they're unusual or that they're special snowflakes. To me, the interesting thing about it is that they're probably fairly common. There are probably many more of them, and there may be an even bigger prize out there. What was challenging about doing this analysis was building the technology to take these pictures, to collect these images, to see this 100,000-mile-away flicker of candle and recognize it for what it was. It took years of effort. However, these tools now work, and that means that we can apply these same search tools that found Dede to the rest of our data set, and they will find more things. In fact, we found about 50 other trans-Neptunian minor planets. Dede is simply the largest and the most interesting. But, of course, the bigger prize out there is Planet 9. Now, we've got a survey that's covering an eighth of the sky to a greater depth than has ever been reached by any other survey of comparable area. And now we have the tools that can pull these very faint planets out of an extremely large, noisy data set. We started with 16,000 pictures of the sky containing a total of about 1 billion objects, mostly stars and galaxies. We finally built the tools with my collaborators at Penn to find the transients, find the things that were moving. But there were still 5 million of those, and maybe a tenth of a percent of those 5 million transients were trans-Neptunian minor planets. It was a problem of finding a really small needle in a really big haystack, but now we figured out how to do that. And that's, to me, the interesting thing. Dede is cool. I'm happy we found it. I'm happy the students got to participate in that discovery. But to me, it is pointing the way to larger discoveries out there like Planet 9. Planet 9 was motivated by the idea that if you look at the trans-Neptunian objects with the very longest periods, even longer than Dede, objects that take thousands of years to go around the sun, they follow long elliptical orbits like Dede too, but there's a special thing about those orbits. The ellipses line up in the same direction. They're long, skinny things that all point one way, as though they are under the influence of a yet even more distant massive object that's pulling those objects to one side. The shorter period objects don't do that. They're random. But if you look at the longest period ones, they seem to be under the influence of something else.
Bottom line it for me. It's interesting we found Dede. You've got new tools to work with. Any idea how long it'll take to determine if there is a Planet 9?
People have worked out what the orbit of Planet 9 might look like, but we don't know where in its orbit Planet 9 might currently be. What we know is a band on the sky where Planet 9 might be. Part of that band intersects the eighth of the sky that our survey is looking at. If Planet 9 happens to be in there, I believe it is bright enough to show up in our data. And in the next year or so, we'll know if it's there or not. It's a matter of, you know, months to a year, not decades or something like that.
That's pretty exciting. Yeah. David Gerdes is a professor of physics and astronomy at the University of Michigan. They've discovered a new dwarf planet or possibly dwarf planet in the solar system. They're nicknaming it Dede, and they're on the hunt for Planet 9. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Lester.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Energy policy is expected to change under the new Trump administration. Mark A. Bartow is the director of the University of Michigan Energy Institute. He wrote a piece for The Conversation this week about what we will likely see regarding a Donald Trump presidency and energy policy. Trump has said flat out that climate change is a hoax, and he plans to dismantle the Obama administration's energy policies. So what does that look like?
Well, I think it's somewhat difficult to judge from his statements during the campaign because they're not all entirely consistent with each other. But it's pretty clear that he and the people around him want to essentially cancel everything that has been done under the Obama administration related to greenhouse gas emissions, whether it's the COP21 agreement from Paris, the Clean Power Plan, you name it.
Climate change effects are going to continue regardless of federal government policies, and the private sector seems to be moving ahead now. They've realized, hey, we're seeing change. We got to adapt or we're going to pay big later. An example, reinsurers are looking at the big picture and saying, hey, look, at this rate, we're going to see these effects and this is the cost they have to. I mean, they have to look a few decades in advance. So a lot of companies themselves are looking at things differently than they were, say, 20 years ago, looking at renewable energy. We're seeing, you know, big box retailers going to LED lighting. We're seeing it makes sense for them because it saves them on the power bill anyway. So why not do this? Some of these responses are going to go ahead with or without policies. But when it comes to renewable energy, some of that's been reliant on federal subsidies. What's going to happen when those disappear?
Well, it's not completely clear they will disappear. Things like the solar tax credit would actually require legislation to repeal. The production tax credit for wind energy, Congress has been renewing off and on for two decades. And in fact, the fact that that's not permanent has made wind development bumpier than it might otherwise have been. But on the Republican side, you have folks like Senator Chuck Grassley from Iowa, who has said that Trump would get rid of, for example, the renewable fuel standard that helps Iowa corn and the production tax credit that helps Iowa wind over his dead body. So on many of these things, the boundaries are not drawn along partisan or ideological boundaries, but much more local interest. What's good for my state?
And that's, you know, one thing that Trump saw. I mean, he's talked a lot about using more clean coal. And I will say that clean coal is an industry term. There is no such thing as clean coal, but that's something he says he's going to bring back. But is there a market for that anymore? Coal's been decreased because we've got cheaper natural gas. It seems to be plentiful at the moment. I guess they could transition back, but there doesn't seem to be a great demand for that. What's going to happen there?
I think that's exactly right. You know, the EPA or the Clean Power Plan is not what is killing coal. It's cheap and abundant natural gas. And so he's also talked about dramatic expansion of drilling for oil and gas, including on federal lands.
Public lands, yeah.
Yes. So that's really the dagger in the heart of coal. He may think that he can promote some exports. I think there are infrastructure challenges with that. There are global market issues with that as other countries around the world burn less coal as well. Clean coal, I think usually, as the politicians bandy it about, means cleaning up the sulfur and nitrogen oxides and mercury. In my view, that's not clean. Clean coal to compete with clean natural gas would also require considerable reduction of carbon dioxide, and that costs money.
Right. Natural gas is, what, about 50% of the CO2 emissions that coal is?
That's about right, yes, per unit of energy generated. So that's an interesting question. How far would Trump go essentially mandating environmental expenditures for clean coal to put coal miners back to work? Again, you've got two almost completely conflicting agendas there.
Outline broadly, what will energy policy look like with Trump, or is there any way to tell at this point?
The one thing that he has been clear and consistent about has been wiping out all of EPA's activities beyond simply clean water and clean air. Now, an interesting thing there, of course, is that the Supreme Court has ruled that the Clean Air Act requires the EPA to address CO2 as a pollutant. So, you know, you can get Congress to change the Clean Air Act, which you may recall goes back to the Nixon administration, or you can perhaps get the Supreme Court to change its mind after you've put a couple of people on it. So, you know, there's some things he can do basically with regard to the international focus of the Clean Power Plan fairly easily and quickly. There are other things that are rooted in long-standing law in the United States that will be harder to undo. Of course, Congress can always choose to not fund certain activities of agencies, even if those activities are required by previous law.
Let's look at climate change before we let you go. If the U.S. doesn't pursue some changes in emissions, greenhouse gases, will that affect how the rest of the world looks at climate change and whether it does anything about it?
Absolutely. And I would say that pulling back from the commitments that have been made by the Obama administration is nothing short of a global tragedy. I think we're going to see some of the largest coal-burning nations like China continue on a path to reduced emissions, reduce coal, in part because they have an issue at home with the pollution of their cities. So they have an important domestic driver to do this. India is another question. I think that that's an important and large economy that sees itself growing primarily on increased energy from coal. And to the extent that there is not a global consensus and a global willingness to help find other pathways, I think that it's going to be difficult for developing countries to take any path other than burn.
Burn, baby, burn. So I want to ask you something. You're a policy guy. You're a scientist. But like all of us, you've got a personal stake in this. How does this make you feel, this idea that we might drastically alter our environment and energy policies in the United States in a way that many of us see as detrimental?
To be honest, it makes me ashamed to be an American right now. It's very hard to face international colleagues and explain to them. It's hard to face our students, my children. You know, this is moving the world off of a path that was very hard won. You know, the process for controlling atmospheric emissions, you know, going back to the Montreal Protocol that reduced chlorofluorocarbons, eliminated them, these are all part of a global consensus and a global approach to these problems that has been 40 years in the making. And to see that destroyed by a group of ideologues is tragic. The thing that makes it doubly tragic is that the clock is ticking. Even meeting the climate goals of Paris would have been challenging anyway. And the longer we wait, the harder it becomes, the more we lock ourselves into higher global temperatures. And so not only are we going the wrong way, but we are losing precious time to address some of these challenges.
That's Mark Bartow. He is director of the University of Michigan Energy Institute. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
This week, first, we heard the owners of the Detroit News were offering buyouts to all of the newspaper's editorial staff. And later in the week, we learned the owners of the Detroit Free Press were offering buyouts to 17 editorial staff. Without enough buyouts, both papers could end up laying off staff. It worries those of us who fear this might end in the death of one paper or the other. There are fewer than a dozen two daily print newspaper towns left in the United States. Seattle, Washington used to be one, no longer. The Seattle Post-Intelligencer became online only, leaving only the Seattle Times printing a daily paper. Joining us now is editor-at-large and columnist for Seattle Magazine, Knut Berger. What does a city lose when it no longer has two daily papers?
Yeah, that's a great question. I've always described it as you lose the ability to see the city in three dimensions. It's kind of like going from being able to get multiple viewpoints and, you know, coverage that doesn't overlap, and then suddenly you're getting your sort of dominant view is a two-dimensional sort of flat screen. And, I think it's a real loss.
I remember when UPI didn't compete on the same level with AP anymore, and nationwide there was a feeling that without that competition, there just wasn't the edge, the drive for being first, being right kind of thing. And I can see that happening in a local area. But I want to ask you about this particular thing in Seattle, because you've still got an online news service there with the Seattle PI. Most people get their newspaper stories on computer, a tablet, a phone anyway. So does having a print paper really make a difference?
Well, I think it makes a difference in a couple of ways. First of all, I mean, the economic model, it was successful, allowed for news or print publications to have fairly large newsrooms. And so the loss with the PI, I mean, you can go to the seattlepi.com website. There are a few writers left that were part of the paper, but by and large, you know, it's an aggregator with a few original stories. You just don't have the large newsroom of feisty reporters that you used to have. And meanwhile, the Seattle Times, the surviving paper, has had cutback after cutback. So what's really lost is the sort of level and depth of the content. The other thing is that having more than two newspapers, you know, allows you to have two different editorial staffs that may have very different views about what's important in the city. So they tend to cover more ground. And the ground they do cover that overlaps is often from a different perspective. So you may have one group that has more skeptical sports writers than the other, or you may have one that it emphasizes one kind of investigative reporting and the other, you know, promotes a different kind. So you just lose a lot of diversity. You lose a lot of depth. You know, people here have responded to the loss.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that because nature abhors a vacuum. I mean, you know, is what fills the gap? Who steps in when there's an opportunity?
Yeah. Well, here we have two alternative newspapers, Seattle Weekly and The Stranger. The Seattle Weekly is kind of a shadow of its former self, but The Stranger has beefed up its news coverage. You know, it comes from a fairly, you know, sort of far left urban bias. They've really done well in terms of beefing up their reporting staff. They won a Pulitzer Prize a few years ago. So they've stepped into the thing. But even their publisher realizes that, you know, they couldn't do the job of covering the city, that the remaining daily, the Seattle Times, is an important part of the ecosystem. I also write for a nonprofit politics and culture website called crosscut.com, which is affiliated with a local public television station. So some nonprofit websites popped up like ours. And then some of the reporters who left got into various ventures. One of the great PI sports columnists, Art Thiel, started a website called Sports Press Northwest that does really great sports coverage. Other reporters went to Investigate West. So the nonprofit sector has sort of been stepping in, either nonprofit or low profit, has stepped in to try and fill some of that void.
I want to ask you, this is kind of an unrelated question, but it's really on the mind of journalists right now. There's a lot of concern about all the fake news sites. And when you, again, have an opportunity where you're not seeing the kind of coverage or complete coverage you might want to see, here's an opportunity for, I'll call them scammers, to step in. What do you think of that trend as mainstream media is weakened because not enough ad revenue and not enough readership in the newspapers?
You know, fake news is not a new thing, but certainly it's kind of a virus that's infected social media in a way that we haven't quite seen before. And I think one of the things that many of the old dailies built up over the years was credibility. And whether you agreed with their editorial page or not, in general, the daily newspapers embraced a very fact-oriented approach to coverage, and you could count on the stories there being factual, being true, whether or not you liked the news you were getting or not. And there's always some suspicion that, you know, the daily papers were biased, you know, based on what the view on the editorial page. Most people don't understand how that works. But
right. They don't understand that firewall. No, there's no doubt about that.
Yeah. And, you know, now we're seeing what happens when there's no firewall, there are no walls at all.
Right.
And the other thing, you know, I was editor of the alternative paper here for many years, the Seattle Weekly. And when I left, somebody asked me, well, what do you miss about it? And I said, the only thing I miss is the audience. Over a period of, you know, 25 years or so, our newspaper had cultivated a really great audience of very engaged, very civic-minded people. Daily newspapers have the same thing. Even though those audiences have shrunk, those people are interested in actual news. Mostly they're people who are civically engaged. And when a newspaper goes away, those people tend to disperse. They don't necessarily flock to the next website or the next radio station or the next newspaper that comes along. So there's a tremendous loss in terms of those audiences that have been cultivated, in the case of the PI, cultivated over the course of more than a century.
Right.
And you can't go out and just replicate that.
I want to ask you something that you know print better than I. We hear about, you know, online competition has been a problem, loss of readership, loss of ad revenue. But the thing that I don't hear as much about outside of the print business, people outside of the print business talking about, is these large corporations buying up these newspapers, wanting more profit. And I'm wondering, are they wanting more profit than is possible for most of these news operations? And trying to become efficient only becomes scaling back to the point of elimination.
Well, I think the newspapers in the 20th century were sort of living a dream. They were making huge profits. Profit margins were, in some cases, particularly in markets where papers had monopolies, they could make 30-40% profit margin. I mean, it was really crazy, the kind of thing that maybe Microsoft was able to do in the early days. The economic model changed dramatically in multiple ways. And so people began consolidating newspapers and cutting costs in order to keep those profit margins or at least boost them substantially. But as the entire model, everything from, you know, Craigslist decimating classified business to things like box chain retailers replacing local retailers and the advertising in different ways, you know, it's just had this dramatic effect. And the fact is that now the newspaper business is a very low profit, not necessarily quite nonprofit, but very low profit enterprise that has the ability to continue to generate revenues through print, but is seeing so much of its audience, you know, end up online where there isn't a guaranteed revenue model that works. So they're really stuck. I mean, it's sort of like you've got a foot on a boat and a foot on the dock, and the two are going in opposite directions.
That's Knut Berger. He's editor at large and columnist for Seattle Magazine, also formerly a longtime editor at the Seattle Weekly. Hey, thanks for your insights. I appreciate it.
Yeah, you bet.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mike Blank, sufficiently engineered by Rusty Brock. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mercedes Mejia, Lindsay Scullin, Ryan Grimes, Josh Hakala, Nick Wallace, Liz Dickey, and Cass Adair. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening. Have a nice weekend.